I'm so impressed you're all here. I would not be if I wasn't presenting. I have the great pleasure and privilege of working with many, including Hank, who's right there, and Jamila, who unfortunately is not here. If you came to the reception for Food Nutrition, you saw his film about Dig Deep, and he, among many other things, manages Dig Deep Farms and Produce, and Jamila manages Whole Community Project, and those are two examples of food system projects I'm going to talk about today. And I would also just say that while I'm framing this as obesity and hunger prevention, most of the projects that I know about and have worked with talk about their work as having many other benefits besides these. And we have no relationships to disclose. So just as a background as well as an outline, food insecurity and obesity are at record highs. I'm not going to say any more about that. But while these issues have some common solutions, the movements have been largely separate, and I'll trace that very quickly. However, many sort of grassroots community-based initiatives are addressing these and other issues through trying to increase local control over food systems, and I'll talk about two examples of that. So here we have from the 40s to today. I'm going to briefly go over the issue histories of food security and obesity and what we've done. One thing they have in common is in the 40s, we started school lunch because of hunger. The military recruits were too thin and malnourished to be drafted. And so they created the school lunch program for that reason and to get rid of our commodities. And the link to obesity, of course, is most recently the retired military leaders say we're too fat to fight. We're looking at school lunch in the other way. Hunger really burst in an official way into the national scene with Michael Harrington's book. He was a political scientist, but he is well ahead of the rest of us in noting the connection between obesity and hunger, that people are sometimes fat with hunger. And that book inspired the Congressional Delta Tour, where Senator Kennedy very optimistically thought, how can we allow it? Maybe we just don't know. I don't know if we can claim we don't know anymore, but we still allow it. and that began food banks started in the 70s, partly in response to that. But then on the obesity side, the first call to alarm about it as a national problem was the Surgeon General's report on nutrition and health, where they were really worried that we're eating too much fat. The fear of fat began with that. And then I'm going to zoom in to the last couple of decades. So the Community Food Security Coalition Response to Hunger was formed in the mid-90s, and as you can see from the way even that font looks, they are not a government organization. And as opposed to the response to obesity, which was much more official, and the CDC's Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity was founded in the late 90s in response to obesity on the government side. We started measuring obesity officially, hunger for the first time only in 1998 with the household measure that USDA came out with. And I know you've seen these maps, but I'm showing them to you for measurement reasons. If you see by 1994, we have complete data for the country on obesity, and with data starting in the 80s, with Wyoming being the very last state to have the statistical significance to turn in their data. So we had complete BMI data by the mid-90s. We didn't even start measuring hunger until 1998. The next big alarm about obesity was the call to action in 2001, the Surgeon General, about prevention. And again, on the obesity side, you can see a lot of attention. There have now been 5 official Institute of Medicine reports about what we should do about obesity. There is the Convergence Partnership that started in 2008, a partnership between Robert Wood Johnson and CDC and others. So a nice private foundation and a public partnership to prevent obesity. NCORE, the National Collaborative, which there are some presentations about that at APHA. And, of course, the Obama Let's Move initiative, all to prevent obesity. And you can see the comparative blankness on the left about food security compared to the very full right side about obesity in terms of an official government response. However, that is hardly empty on the food security side in the sense that food security has been largely a community organizing NGO foundation activity, but all the official government action has tended to be about obesity. There's not a single IOM report about food insecurity or hunger. One exciting development in that is that this year there was a workshop at IOM that talked about obesity and hunger together, which is leading us down a path of thinking about food system solutions, perhaps to both. And there's a reason for that, and also to some extent perhaps a result. Obesity tends to be we have a very official public health government response, which has a very different frame than food security or, taking even a little farther, food sovereignty movements in a community level, with strategies being very different, obesity being very intervention-based. Academics and professionals are the ones who are the experts in this. We're looking for BMI change or behavior change. This is shifting, thankfully, but really until the last 3 or 4 years, we focused almost exclusively on lifestyle choices. It's been a slight shift to environmental healthy environments, not necessarily quite out to the food system. And the politics, from sort of right to liberal, whereas if you go over to food security, their goal, their strategies are democracy and local control. It's the citizens who are considered the experts in how to regain control over our food systems, including to create food security and sovereignty. The outcome they want is equity and engagement, and they have a very systems view of how it's all caused, and the politics can be radical, right or left. So mapping sort of these movements, and some people have called the obesity fight a movement. There's hunger and obesity, both of which aren't really good movement grounds because they're negative. Movements are almost always about a solution, not about a problem. But you have sustainability and living wage movements. They're just foodies who like good food. I have to include myself. Community food security. Oops. But I would say that the community food system organizing does not encompass all of those. The Venn diagram's not accurate in that sense, but it does address all of those issues. And people are coming together, finally, from these different movements around food systems to tackle all of the issues in my second version of the title. So I wanted to talk about two projects, one that Hank manages, called Dig Deep Farms and Produce. It was I find several things compelling about this particular example. It came out of the Deputy Sheriff's Activities League, which is like a police activities league, in Alameda County, California, in an area called Cherryland Ashland, which is not incorporated, just south of Oakland. So the bottom right there is Marty, Sheriff Marty Neideffer, and he started DCEL because he was a school resource officer, and he was tired of telling kids that go do something constructive, stop beating each other up, stop doing drugs, stop doing whatever it is that they were doing he didn't want them to do. And then he realized there's nothing constructive for them to do in the community. There was when he grew up there, but there wasn't anymore. So he created this activities league and created a soccer league. And this is him last year opening up the soccer league, which has almost 1,000 kids in a community of 30,000 playing soccer for free. So he had all these activities starting in 2004. Which gave the teenagers something to do, but then they became young adults and there were no jobs. So he's like, I need to create jobs. And somebody gave him Van Jones's book, The Green Collar Economy, and he read it, and this book proposes in the energy sector and in the food sector we can create jobs. And fortunately, Marty ran into Hank, who's been a leader in the food movement, at a public health meeting, and someone introduced them, and so Marty says to Hank, can we do this? Can we create jobs with food systems? And Hank crossed himself and said yes. So I have heard you tell the story that way. And so they launched Dig Deep Farms and Produce just in spring 2010. They have about 10 local community members, many of whom had no job experience, some of whom have been in prison, most of whom are young parents, to become urban farmers and sales and marketing professionals, and have supported and trained them, and now they grow food and put it in boxes and deliver it to people in an area that you could call a food desert. This is the Dig Deep family, and I would say one of their team members pulled this avatar together. And family is not an accident as a word. They're a very cohesive and supportive team. And this is them packing some of the boxes they're going to deliver. They now actually use bags because I think bags are cheaper. But so what they do right now, they have 2.5 acres, but thanks to the county and a private landowner, they are expanding, and they're going to have about 25 acres, including an orchard. They deliver about 100 boxes or bags a week, including now partnering with People's Grocery, which some of you may have heard of. And then they've got about 10 urban farmers and other employees to help them run their business. And the goal, so two things are interesting and unique about this. One, it came out of crime prevention. The idea of creating jobs is crime prevention, but it's also very much obviously a food system activity. And the other is that they are starting, this is not a community, a few community gardens and some dialogues. It's trying to start a business, an alternative food system in Ashland, Cherryland. So their vision is to create this local food economy with jobs, with a sort of vertically integrated, and with people with a democracy and engagement goal about people having a vital stake in their community and breaking the dependency and build self-reliance. The other project I'll talk about is a whole community project where I was very involved as a citizen. And they do two things. One is dialogue, and the other is action. it started out, and oops, oh, I sent you one with the auto forward. I'm in trouble. I forgot about that. I wonder if I can make it stop. I'm not going to go as fast as this does. They started in 2006 as a childhood obesity prevention project. I was involved from the beginning in that. And then in about 2008, Jamila Sakira, she's on the left, my co-author, she came on right about the same time as I was thinking obesity's not the problem, the food system's the problem. And we worked together to start organizing about creating a healthier local food system. So she has hosted 4, 5, maybe 6 food dialogues where people come out and discuss their vision and start action planning about community food systems. And I have to say, I'd never seen such diverse and integrated mixed attendance in anything in Ithaca until she started these dialogues. And now there's a whole host of initiatives. So the whole community project is more a networking and support effort. But they have all come under the umbrella. Most of the food work has come under the umbrella already of Ithaca Community Harvest, so they won't compete against each other. And there's Gardens for Humanity. They've made 5 or 6 community gardens. There's a subsidized CSA share. There's a nascent market box program being sold through one of the schools. There's crop mobs that go and glean or help farmers, flash sort of mobs on farms to help farmers. And then if it's gleaning, they donate the food to a fruit and vegetable snack program. So there's a new farmers training initiative, all within the last 3 years. Almost all of that was in the last 3 years. Just an example of another initiative that came out of this, the Congo Square Market, which was founded with just a $3,000 mini grant. And Jakeem Haltom, he worked in the Youth Bureau, and there's lots of farmers markets in Ithaca, but they tend to be very expensive and culturally exclusive, very white, very upper middle class, very expensive. And he founded a market called Congo Square Market in the South Side communities, a historically African American community, to help build their economic base, their support for new vendors, for people new to vending, financial and technical, and to encourage community and personal health. And it's on every Friday night, and it's a party. And they're in their third year, and it's become a real center for people to hang out every Friday in that neighborhood, as well as have access to fruits and vegetables and the other things that are sold at the market. Another initiative, this is probably the biggest thing they've taken on in Ithaca, is a grocery store closed down in one of the poorest neighborhoods in Ithaca, and Tops bought out PNC, and they decided it was profitable but not profitable enough to shut down the store. And there's a whole community that this is the only store they can walk to. So the owners of the property did because of this organizing that was already happening, it was easy for them to consult with the people who've been organizing around the food system, ask them what they wanted, and they want a community food center. So they're trying to open a grocery store that's called Neighborhood Pride. And they're trying to access some of that fresh food financing initiative money that New York has made available, and they might be applying for some federally. They are struggling to open, however, because of the huge startup capital costs and because they're not going to be part of the chain. They couldn't find a chain that they thought was appropriate for the neighborhood with quality food who would work with them. So they're still working on that. With some irony, there's a mural on the side of that building that has this Food for Life that was there. It's been there for at least as long as I was in Ithaca. But I think it's a sign of the destiny for that. For that space, and you know, all of this has become. we're learning just starting about 6 months ago, with these two community food projects, as well as three others, two in Wyoming, where I now am, Wind River Reservation in my own county, and East New York Farms, which is a farming project in Brooklyn that's been going for 13 years. And so these five community food projects are working with us to figure out how they got. Do case studies, essentially, of how they got to where they are today, and tracing their work and learning from them and with them for the next 4.5 years. The project's called Food Dignity. And we've already started our case study research. I should add that each place is also getting a support package. They get halftime community organizer, mini grants, animators to help people apply for those mini grants, and so they have their own research budgets, and some of the things I'm forgetting. So, but already looking at those five places, and especially these two, and my own personal experience being part of the whole community project, some of the challenges are not necessarily money overall, but cash flow is a real clincher for making real change. So it's not that they're short of money necessarily, but that they have trouble, for example, opening that grocery store, and certainly dig deep trying to run a business and meet payroll every month with 10 employees. They have lots of grants in the pipeline, lots of grants that have been awarded, but the cash doesn't flow. Payment for services is often slow to small organizations, so cash flow is almost as much of a problem as actually total access to money overall. Again, these are provisional thoughts based on our experience to date. The internal stress, everyone is, anyone who does this work knows you get maxed out really easily. Whole community project is based at Cornell Cooperative Extension, and they call it overextension. some of them are committed about 160% of their time on various grants. So there's just the stress through the roof. A lot of people have two part-time jobs. They're playing different roles, including Hank, actually works half-time for Food Dignity, half-time running Dig Deep. They're both full-time jobs. And then in the way that also then manifests for people, the strife that happens internally, partly because of that stress and partly because this is vision and principles-based. The magnitude of course, what they're up against, a $2 billion Coke budget is kind of hard to match when you're trying to market your fruits and vegetables. And by tapping the roots, I mean, obviously the people who know most about food insecurity, know most about their communities, are often least able to come to the table, especially if you have official meetings at particular times with no child care, transport, or financial support. Promising and successful strategies include, of course, you need lots of funding streams to keep on balancing out your money. Ideally, you'd have credit lines, but that's a leap that hopefully we'll learn to take. A lot of places are bridging silos, like the sheriff's department's working with the county in Dig Deep, working with the county, working with public health, and many other agencies working with the fire department, bridging people who have not traditionally been involved. And that's a blend of leveraging new resources and bridging people who haven't worked together. Job creation is the number one priority with everyone I've talked with, using these to create jobs, not just to build, say, gardens. Mini grants seem very promising to engage people, grassroots people, being able to implement their own solutions. Waiting, by which I mean sometimes academics or upper middle class white people love to rush into action. We have to do something now, and that's instead of at the exclusion of getting other people to the table and taking leadership from the people who are most effective. So that can mean waiting and having it be principles based. To guide your work. So that's my presentation. I'd like to thank these supports, and those are our email addresses. Thank you.